an international nuclear ingathering. When the United Nations holds its third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons next week, the official 5 days of events for the UN representatives will not be the only story. Starting on Sunday, March 2nd, more than 250 activists from around the world will gather at the All-Day Nuclear Campaigner Forum. It will bring together partners and allies in the effort to eliminate nuclear weapons and support justice for those affected by nuclear weapons use and testing. During the week, while the state's parties meet, side events by and for campaigners will take place, focusing on the various issues faced by different countries to allow for campaigners to network and set the groundwork for collaboration throughout the year. It's a rare opportunity, and as one ICANN organizer central to this effort tells us,
this, I think, inclusivity and this variety of stakeholders really speaks to something that's essential and new about this treaty, which is that it's always been about bringing everybody to the table because nuclear weapons affect all of us. So we all need to bring in our own voices and our own concerns and try to move this forward. But perhaps a UN meeting with all of its formality doesn't give the space for everything that needs to happen. But since everybody is in the same city for such a global campaign, that's a rarity. And that is why we use moments like these to have separate events, which then feed in to the meeting of states parties themselves.
Well, when Lucero Oyarzun, digital campaign organizer for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, shares a sense of who is getting together and what's ahead at the UN, you wouldn't be remiss in growing heart and hope that we will find a solution to that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Lucero Oyarzun. She is digital campaign organizer for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN. And she is coordinating the live stream and regular reports from the UN in the coming week. Learn how you can participate even from a distance and gain the latest information on these crucial meetings of nations from around the world. And to give you a taste of what we'll be presenting in the coming weeks on Nuclear Hot Seat, we'll have a look back at a few of the interviews from the 2023 second meeting of states parties, specifically with politicians from Massachusetts, Des Moines, Iowa, and Hiroshima. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor with another story from our shared history of successful activist resistance and more honest nuclear information than anyone will bother to mention at the Oscars. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 25th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., Constellation Energy said that the company is on schedule to restart one of the nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island and has made significant progress in hiring for the facility. They say they have hired 200 of the roughly 600 full-time employees who will work at what they call Crane Clean Energy Center, that clean being a lie in the middle of the name. But that is the new name for the facility previously known as Three Mile Island, the reactor next to the one that suffered a meltdown on March 28, 1979. Constellation has targeted a reopening of the facility by the end of second quarter in 2027. The reason for the rush? All energy from this facility is going to be purchased by Microsoft for a new data center. But the wisdom of pouring all that money and all that energy into restarting a nuclear reactor that is already more than 50 years old in terms of its technology is yet to be determined. In Andrews County, West Texas, Interim Storage Partners plans to build an interim storage facility, interim being a relative term, for spent nuclear fuel at the existing WCS disposal site in Andrews County, Texas. The Supreme Court will rule whether the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had authority to grant a construction and operation license for the privately owned facility. The conservative court's decision could lock in spent fuel storage options for decades. There's an extensive article on this in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists online publication, and we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 713. And another fascinating article from thebulletin.org by Allison McFarland, who was chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission between July 2012 and December 2014, entitled, "Trump Just Assaulted the Independence of the Nuclear Regulator. What Could Go Wrong?" She writes that through the recent executive order by the president attacking independent regulatory agencies in the U.S. government, independent regulators will no longer be free from industry and political influence. McFarland boils it down to the basics. Quote, "This essentially means subordinating regulators to the president." Her observations are to the point, well-grounded, and terrifying. I'll have a link to it up on the website. Over to Japan, where that country's decision to skip the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons meetings at the United Nations, despite the efforts of Nobel Prize-winning campaigners, has sparked condemnation from activists who have said that Tokyo is missing a critical chance to advocate for disarmament. Before the Nobel Committee announced that Nihon Hidankyo, the Japan Confederation of A and H Bomb Sufferers Organizations, won the Nobel Peace Prize in December for its 68-year campaign against nuclear weapons, some members of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party said they were considering sending representatives this year. That position was partially influenced by pressure from Komieto, the Buddhist-backed party in the Liberal Democratic Party's ruling coalition. More recently, Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba informed Komieto that he was considering sending a representative as an observer. But on February 18, Foreign Minister Takashi Iwaya announced that Japan would not send an observer to New York because Tokyo depended on the nuclear umbrella that the U.S. provided, saying, "It would not be appropriate for Japan to participate as an observer. Doing so would send the wrong message about nuclear deterrence." We have a quote about the true nature of what is called deterrence by U.S. President John F. Kennedy at the end of this program. In Fukushima, a tiny piece of nuclear fuel debris that was extracted from the damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has been revealed to reporters in all of its glory. Almost 14 years after the disaster first began, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, crowed about retrieving 0.7 grams of material in its first test extraction operation. They even released a photo of the sample, but without any means of comparing it to something where we know the size and we can figure out how big this sample is. In truth, it weighs approximately as much as one-third of a U.S. dime, and there's a long way to go before that will translate into the safe removal of 880 tons of the stuff. And an excellent compendium of exactly how Fukushima pollution spread radioactivity far and wide, written by John LaForge, who has been a commentator on Nuclear Hot Seat. We'll link to this extensive article on our website as well. And on February 24th, French President Emmanuel Macron met with U.S. President Donald Trump in D.C. to discuss efforts towards a ceasefire in the ongoing Russian-Ukraine war. Macron not only reiterated France's commitment to a robust peace agreement that preserves Ukraine's sovereignty, but also offered a powerful defense proposal for Europe: Rafale fighter jets armed with nuclear weapons that could be deployed in Germany as part of an initiative to strengthen Europe's nuclear deterrence and provide a nuclear shield for the continent. The Rafale is not only capable of conducting conventional missions, but also plays a critical role in France's strategic nuclear deterrence. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, here we go. I leave for the United Nations meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, this week. The countries that have signed and ratified the ban, which is international law, along with those countries in the ratification process, those that are considering it, and others that claim to merely be observing the process, will come together at the UN for these meetings March 3 through 7. As you will hear, campaigner activities start on Sunday, March 2nd. My goal is to cover as many of the events as I can, to bring you exclusive interviews with everyone from campaigners to delegates, and to bolster our vision of a nuclear weapons-free world. It's an exciting time, filled with possibility, potential, and hope, as well as the energy that comes from so many like-minded individuals from around the world having a time and place to come together. If we are to succeed in saving the world from a nuclear holocaust, this is the community, these are the people at the core of making that happen. I want to thank those of you who have donated to support this trip so that I may provide the coverage. You have made this possible. But there is much more to be done with the show, including digital media trainings and the chance to hire social media help to get the show further out there. And it's time. To help get Nuclear Hot Seat more visible in the world, I continue to ask for your help. A donation of any size that is tax deductible. And we make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Or if you can send money directly through Zelle, do so to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know that whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And as always, I'm deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. The United Nations meetings will be accessible online internationally through the work of ICANN's digital campaign coordinator, Lucero Oyarzun. And, of course, we will let you know how to access the channels where it's available. I spoke with Lucero Oyarzun on February 21st, 2025. Lucero Oyarzun, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really appreciative of you taking time when I know your schedule must be just jammed now, getting ready for the events of next week. Let's start out with a little bit about you. What is your background and what is your position at ICANN?
I rolled into this work, I think, perhaps in a slightly different line than many others on the ICANN team. I'm more of an environmentalist by background. I did forest and nature conservation, but I really like the communication side, and through organizations like Greenpeace. I wound up also hearing about the incredible work being done by nuclear testing survivors around the world to kind of fight for nuclear justice and also environmental remediation. And when the chance popped up with ICANN to kind of continue in my own line of work, I jumped at it, and I've been here for nearly 7 years now.
Your position is digital campaign coordinator. What does that mean, and what has been the focus of your work?
So it's been quite varied. I like to say I'm a Jill of all trades, because it is very much making sure that as the little engine here in the middle that powers this campaign, we are providing ICANN campaigners around the world with the different tools they need in order to make the case locally that the TPNW is the path forward, right? How do they effectively campaign to abolish nuclear weapons? And that is a very custom answer, depending on where you are. And we really like to provide the resources, where possible, the tools, templates, in order to give campaigners as many ways as possible to get that message to decision makers, whether it's at the city level or governments, right, or in multilateral events like the upcoming meeting of states parties. So in terms of digital, it's really spun the gamut, from website building to social media content, to live streams production, to different toolkits that can really help our campaigners kind of hit the ground running whenever something comes up. We're quite lucky to obviously have a team that's grown and keeps on growing, with a head of media, with a social media officer, right? So that more of these tasks get separated out. But it's very much still a campaign effort. And it's also seeing what our campaigners are up to, what our different staff team are up to, and amplifying that and making sure it ends up in as many inboxes as possible. And that as many people, when they are looking for resources on nuclear war, because they're worried, that they end up on our guide about nuclear anxiety, and that that encourages them to take action, right? So it's all of these different digital tricks and tools and tips.
And when you say tools and resources, are you talking about scripted material or training in how to use the digital resources? What's the nature of the support that you give?
It varies, to be honest. We've done trainings, for example, on photography, for actions, on how to use specific social media tools. But we've also just kind of created scripted materials or templates that everybody can adapt. I think a lot of campaigners nowadays will be familiar with Canva, which is a kind of a more accessible graphics editing tool than Adobe. And this is the kind of thing that we like to make sure campaigners around the world have easy access to.
You are based in Geneva, Switzerland, as the core group of ICANN is. When you come to New York, what are your duties? What do you have to set up and be prepared for in terms of digital flexibility and ability during the TPNW meetings?
The good thing is that this is not the first time we've done this. So we know a little bit more what to expect, but we want to make sure that there are moments for people back home who weren't able to join the meeting to engage. We also want to make sure that everybody knows how to find their way around things, right? Around the UN, around the different events that are happening. So a lot of these materials we have prepared beforehand. We have a calendar of events that's broken down by different themes, right? That people can kind of monitor and just easily access on their phone. We will be organizing, setting up 3 live streams from New York that kind of bring in different speakers from the governments, from experts, to speak to what is happening in the room, what is being decided, and what's at stake. We've done this before for the both previous MSPs. We affectionately call it MSP TV, because it's the idea that people can really tune in. And this year, we want to try to get in some questions from the people who watch, because we think, again, we are making this tool for the people who are kind of in the know and really care. Right? Because you don't just tune in to a UN treaty unless you're familiar with the issue. And of course, we are also making sure that people know that for those who really want to go deep, the UN will be streaming the meetings happening in the room. But it gets a little trickier when you come to the side events, the events happening outside the main room, which are largely organized by governments, but also by civil society and a lot of ICANN partners. Because of costs, because of the technical complexities of setting up a stream, more often than not, these won't be live streamed. However, from previous years, we know that a lot of the organizers themselves will be very keen to share this on social media. This is really what we encourage, and we really want people to engage with this and follow the updates there.
There is an event before the official kickoff at the United Nations, which takes place on Sunday, March 2nd, which is the Campaigners Forum. Define for the listeners, who is a campaigner and what is the purpose of this forum, which goes for most of the day?
That's a tricky question because I think you can make it quite broad, and we like to be broad. We like to be inclusive about who we see as an ICANN campaigner. It can obviously come from many different angles. As I said, I came from the environmental side myself, but it can also be people who are here to campaign on their nuclear justice issues. But what we share in common, particularly for the MSP, but in general, as part of ICANN, is the solid support for the UN treaty banning nuclear weapons, the MSP, what we're here to kind of talk about, right? It's this belief that the only way to be safe from the nuclear threat is to eliminate nuclear weapons altogether. So we want campaigners to be able to say those lines clearly and powerfully, and to kind of, whatever their local context is, find the way to make that argument. And I think that's what unites us as campaigners. It's people who do advocacy, but it can also be people who engage on social media, right? It can be people who are in very high level meetings, or it can be people who protest at bases. I thought your recent interview with the US nun who had been in the Buchel base was incredibly powerful. And we would also have like consider this kind of activism to be campaigning. But it is also campaigning to be in a UN meeting under those bright lights in meeting after meeting, right? So as long as what you're doing is advocating for this cause, we don't want to close the doors and say what that would be.
That is one of the events that will have taken place before I produce the show for that week, which means I will be able to report on it. What are some of the aspects that are going to be at that? I remember from a year and a half ago, from the two MSP meetings, that Melissa Park was just beginning at ICANN, and she did address the group, and then there were panels, there were other things as well. Is she going to be addressing the group again? And if so, what are some of the other portions of that day's gathering?
I'm very glad you remember your own experience with the Campaigners Forum last time very fondly, because it is one of the moments that we really look forward to ahead of each of these meetings. Our campaigners are really the people who get the work done. And we see these meetings as moments to kind of rally and learn from each other and discuss the big topics at hand. We will be hearing from our executive director, Melissa Park, again. We will also be hearing from a variety of campaigners and experts and diplomats throughout the day to give a context of where we are now, right? So, what is the problem of nuclear weapons now? What are the humanitarian impacts? But also, what should we expect from this meeting? We're going into a week of meetings, and this is the latest information in order to be ready to hit the ground running come Monday morning. So there's going to be a lot of that. We're also really looking forward to having some breakout sessions where people can kind of brainstorm and work together on themes of nuclear justice or connecting different campaigns. We're also looking at talking about stigmatizing nuclear weapons and about how to work on promoting the treaty in different states. So it's a big variety and it's going to be a full agenda. And we're really looking forward to seeing the energy in the room. When we originally booked our venue in the Riverside Church, we made an estimate of how many campaigners we thought would come. And then we sold out the tickets in 10 days. And in discussion with the venue, we were able to bump up to a slightly larger room. But it's one of these exciting moments that reflects how vibrant this campaign is.
I think that's one of the things that was most impressive to me, because when I went into the room, we were not an official session. It was just people milling around and talking with each other. And I could walk up to anyone. I was doing brief interviews, walk up to anyone and start talking with them. They were from all over the world. They were committed. They were articulate. They were up on all the issues, which is something I'm not used to encountering here in the US. And it was such a rich and a vibrant environment on behalf of getting rid of nuclear weapons that it was heady. It was exciting. It was one of the biggest infusions of hope that I have received in 13 and a half years so far of doing Nuclear Hot Seat. So I'm very much looking forward to being there again and covering that. Now, you said that there will be UNTV. Is that a channel? Is that something that is available outside of the United Nations or approved venues?
The UN streams a lot of its large official meetings on, I want to say, webtv.un.org. That is webtv.un.org. But this is the full block of three-hour meetings of every person delivering their statements, right? So this is really for if you're deep into the details and deep into the weeds on this. But it is an incredibly useful resource when you've missed a moment or you want to catch up on the speeches. I will have to say there are hardcore campaigners out there who do listen to this or who pay extra attention when their own country gets a chance to speak. It is available for everybody to catch up online. There's no such thing as like a curated feed where you can just select the meeting of states parties. So you will have to do a little bit of digging in their live schedule yourself to find this. What we provide as ICANN is a summary that is a live streamed for everybody to see that catches the highlights and insights from the meeting of states parties and the different Nuclear Ban Week events that we call MSPTV. And that will be live at icannw.org/MSPTV, Monday, March 3rd, Wednesday, March 5th, and Friday, March 7th at noon Eastern time. What makes this broadcast different to the live stream is that we try to provide the context, right? We give people a chance to keep track of the most salient discussions and to hear analysis from the experts about what's happening to improve the treaty, to strengthen it, and a little bit of what's happening behind the scenes. So I'm really hoping that everybody will tune in. I've produced MSPTV for all three of the MSPs now with a different composition of professional support in each time. And it's been wonderful to see to work with our hosts, our so-called roaming reporter who gets stuff for social media, volunteers or professional crew who can kind of help manage the technical equipment and wrangle people in and out of the room, but particularly also all of our guests to really fine-tune the questions and fine-tune the programming so that we really are able to give the best possible recap for the people who are at home. One of the things that really stands out to me from the second MSP was how eager diplomats from the organizing kind of bodies, right? So from UNODA, but also from Mexico, were to engage with MSPTV because they understand that the people who care about this issue deserve to hear directly from them what progress is being made.
This is all very exciting. With so many side events, are there certain ones or certain groups of them that stand out to you that you could bring to our awareness now?
Yes, absolutely. The first thing that stands out, obviously, is that we have very big events for elected representatives, the Parliamentarian Forum, the Youth MSP, which has really become a staple of these meetings of states parties, and different events happening for affected communities. This, I think, inclusivity and this variety of stakeholders really speaks to something that's essential and new about this treaty, which is that it's always been about bringing everybody to the table because nuclear weapons affect all of us. So we all need to bring in our own voices and our own concerns and try to move this forward. But perhaps a UN meeting with all of its formality doesn't give the space for everything that needs to happen. But since everybody is in the same city for such a global campaign, that's a rarity. And that is why we use moments like these to have separate events, which then feed in to the meeting of states parties themselves.
What kind of a boost was acknowledged or manifested itself after the second meeting of states parties, when the campaigners went back to their home to continue? Was there an increase in activity? Were there more people involved? What did this do for them?
We always hear from people first that they go home exhausted but very happy, right? It is a very intense week, but people really know what they have done it for. And we do see upticks in very specific projects, right? And we also see a lot more collaborations. I think that's one of the things that most stands out to me from the second MSP to now has been how particularly young campaigners know how to find each other and organize different events together, different webinars, how to create social media materials together about specific topics, because they know that they are not alone working on this issue. They have names, they have contact details, and they've got a face and a story, a shared moment. And when they find that and find the topic that they have in common or a path forward, that very often leads itself to just very interesting, I find, collaborations. And it means that we're all kind of more globally aware of how to engage in key moments like the upcoming 80th anniversary of the US atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or of the, you know, the first nuclear weapons test in Trinity. Right. These are all really big moments for the campaign. And what we're hoping to see is that this MSP rallies people to really get active and really do something in this year, which is so critical.
Is there anything we haven't touched upon that you would like to talk about now before you jump right back into the frenzy of work that you must be facing to get ready for this?
Yes, and thank you. I would like to encourage everybody to also weigh in on their preferred social media about what's coming up. We usually use the hashtag nuclear ban because it's the easiest to remember. But for the MSP, we will also be using hashtag TPNW3MSP. And of course, you can follow any of ICANN's social media, and I'm sure for the nuclear hot seat too, to really see what's happening in the room. And be part of it. Even if you're not there, sharing helps. And it shows the world that there's a vibrant movement of people out there who really want to end nuclear weapons. And that's so important right now.
Lucero Oyarzun, you're doing terrific work to get this ready for next week. I know how complex media things can be to set up technically and to organize the people. So you've got your hands full. I will be seeing you there and meeting with you there. And for now, as we both prepare for New York and the third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
Lucero Oyarzun, Digital Campaign Coordinator for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. For those of you who wish to follow the events at the United Nations, we will have links up to the ICANN media page where you can access their videos and also the UN channel. Both will be listed on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 713. When I covered the second meeting of states parties in 2023, politicians and diplomats figured strongly in the Nuclear Hot Seat reports. To whet your appetite for what's to come this year, here are a few samples from previous interviews, and know that everything they are saying is still relevant and important. First, Massachusetts Representative Jim McGovern. He has been a member of the United States House of Representatives since 1997. A Democrat, he is a ranking member of the House Rules Committee. At the second meeting of states parties, he was the first member of Congress and the only one that year to attend. Here's our interview done at the UN on December 2nd, 2023. I'm talking with Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, who is the only representative of Congress at this meeting at the United Nations, the second meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Why you? What brought you here?
Because I think this is, you know, the moral issue of our time. I think this is an issue about whether our planet survives. If you care about the environment, you should care about this issue. If you care about social justice, you should care about this issue. Because we're spending so much of our treasure on modernizing and rebuilding and building new nuclear weapons. We have tens of millions of people in the United States of America that are hungry. I mean, why aren't we feeding them? You know, the world, hunger is a problem around the world. Why aren't we redirecting those monies to solving a problem like that. And so we are slowly but surely building support in Congress for the resolution to abolish nuclear weapons. We have a lot more to do. We are here to build a movement, not just in the United States, but around the world. And after today, I feel that we are on our way. It's not going to happen overnight, but we have to be persistent. This is the right thing to do. You know, and the reason why we need to get more grassroots engagement is because members of Congress and members of parliaments don't always do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. They do it because it's in their political interest. They feel the political pressure. And so we need to build that political pressure. This is about saving the world.
You mentioned we when you were talking about Congress. Are there others who have joined with you in this belief and in pushing this forward?
Yeah, I mean, we have close to 50 co-sponsors already on this bill. I think a lot more will join us, hopefully in the weeks and months to come. You know, I wish I wasn't the only member of Congress here.
Are you the first member of Congress who has come to one of these meetings?
Maybe. I think I may be, which is, I feel ashamed of that fact, quite frankly, because, you know, if this is not an important issue, I don't know what the hell is. We have world leaders right now recklessly using the phrase nuclear war as if it was like inevitable, as if it was like what's going to happen next. That should scare everybody. And it's great to be here with the mayor of Des Moines, because this is not just about this is not just a fight in Congress, it's a fight at the local level too. And so that we have mayors that are engaged in this gives me hope that we're going to get to where we need to get to.
You mentioned a bill. I take it this is in Congress.
Right.
What is that bill? Explain what it is and what it's supposed to do.
So I have a bill. It's H-Res 77 to endorse the treaty to ban nuclear weapons. And so we are slowly but surely building support. But it's important that the United States, a nuclear power, take some leadership on this issue. Nobody here is talking about unilateral disarmament or any of that kind of, we're talking about the whole world doing this, right? And so all these excuses for people not to get on are just that, excuses. I get it. You know, a lot of members of Congress get a lot of money from defense contractors and people who make parts and components and build these nuclear warheads. You know, I get that. But you know what's more powerful than money and defense contractors? Money is people power. And that's what this whole gathering today was about. People from the United States, people from around the world who want to make sure there's a future for their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and beyond. And that's why I'm here.
Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, the first and, to date, only member of the U.S. Congress to attend meetings on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Next, Frank Cowney. He served as mayor of Des Moines, Iowa, from 2004 to 2024. He was also the U.S. vice president for Mayors for Peace. Frank Cowney was still in office when we spoke at the second meeting of states parties in December 2023. An unexpected U.S. government official I met at the UN was Frank Cowney, mayor of Des Moines, Iowa. What's a mayor from the middle of the country doing at an international meeting on nuclear weapons at the UN? More than you might expect.
I'm here as the United States Vice President for the World Mayors for Peace.
You're from where?
Des Moines, Iowa, USA.
And how did you become involved, so involved, with nuclear issues in Des Moines?
We have a big peace movement in our city, and I've worked a long time with those individuals. And when I became mayor 20 years ago, I started working with those individuals. And when I found Mayors for Peace at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, I immediately joined. And, you know, occasionally we have to be careful what we say. And somebody listened to what I had to say and said, oh, let's have him be this. So, you know, I'm proud of that. We have worked really hard with mayors from across the country. We put forward resolutions in front of the U.S. Conference of Mayors regarding peace and the prohibition of nuclear weapons, and to redirect nuclear weapon dollars and money to local governments where people live, work, and hope to prosper and dream to have families or have a business, and not only now but into the far distant future for many generations. And we have to do that, and it's all foundational. And war is not an answer. We have to stay away from war. We have to drive our whole country and the world to understand what happens at the local level and at local government. We solve problems day to day for people. We don't get into those differences of opinion at the heads of state level. We are problem solvers. We try to change people's lives and make a better world for them. And I think that, as you talk to mayors, we're all in that.
What have you accomplished that you're most proud of in terms of the work that you have done with the mayors to promote peace, to come up with these resolutions? Is there one thing you can point to and say, that was a good one, that one landed?
I feel like that every year. We keep moving ahead, and, you know, for 18 years, we have done these resolutions, and we've gotten them accepted. And some people say, well, you'll never get a partisan group. Well, we function in a nonpartisan fashion. We serve all of our citizens, whether they wear blue shirts or red shirts or green shirts or no shirts. Somebody calls with a problem, we try to do it. And this is a huge problem. Peace is something that we need in our country, in North America, in the world. And I'm proud to have been the person for the last, 15 plus years that has presented that resolution and has been able to push it forward and get it accepted most of the time unanimously by the conference. But I also work on similar issues regarding climate. And so it's interesting how, as we talk to the science, how climate and nuclear weapons can be related. Because some of the scientists say nuclear war can never happen because that's the end. 15 to 20 or 25 of them exploded with the power that they have today, which is so much more powerful than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They say that's the end. Game over. We can't let that happen, and we have to educate the world. And I know the young people understand it. We need to educate them. So it's all of us, again, working together. And I think our local voice, we have to speak loud and speak off, whether it's about peace or whether it's about climate. We're the ones that are going to be the implementers of the solutions. Let's plan together. Let's work together. Let's make something good happen.
And if a mayor or someone connected with a mayor or just a citizen who wants to get to a mayor would like to contact you to get more information, where can they go?
They could call the U.S. Conference of Mayors to find out who maybe their closest members of that group are. And then maybe also through the Conference of Mayors, get a hold of Mayors for Peace, because we need more mayors to be working on that as well.
Frank Coney, now the former mayor of Des Moines, Iowa. Finally, I had a brief opportunity to speak with the mayor of Hiroshima, Kazumi Matsui. We spoke through his interpreter.
How do you believe that these meetings at the UN on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons are actually helping us move forward towards that prohibition?
We feel that this treaty is a very important tool to make progress towards the ideal world for the humanity, the world without nuclear weapon. The step might be slow, but we have to make a steady step moving forward. And this tool, we should really use the treaty as a tool to push forward.
What do you think it will take to get Japan to sign on to the treaty?
The Japanese government stance is that currently the nuclear armed the states tackling the Article 6 of NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they are supposed to be working on the nuclear disarmament and then non-proliferation. So this is the first task for the nuclear armed countries, and then that is the first step to secure the global security. That is the first one, and this nuclear ban treaty should come after that. So that is a one theory. And
I'm talking now with Representative Lindsay Sabadosa, who is from Massachusetts and is here for what purpose? Why are you here?
Well, I was invited by constituents to attend this meeting. Even though I don't represent Massachusetts in the federal government, I file a lot of legislation on the state level around stopping the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And so it felt important to be here to hear this exchange of ideas, to sort of understand from parliamentarians around the world what the situation and conversations are like in their countries or in their governments. And I found it to be very useful, quite honestly.
Are you the only state representative you know who is doing this kind of work, or are there others, and are you in touch?
I'm sure that there are others, and we certainly are in touch with other legislators who are trying to do this type of work. What you can do on the state level, of course, is a little bit more limited. However, we've been able to pass legislation, for example, to prohibit on a municipal level contracting with individual companies that manufacture, maintain, or otherwise engage in the nuclear industry. So that was an important win of different communities taking a stand. We are also trying to create a commission in Massachusetts that would look at the state's involvement in the nuclear weapon industry to try to understand if there are ways that we can disengage. One of the key messages we heard today was really how we need to connect the issue of nuclear weapons with the environmental crisis that we're facing. We really should be putting our resources into addressing the right crisis, and that's not war, it's the environmental crisis. So the commission will try to understand how we as a state can take steps forward, even if the federal government doesn't quite want to do that yet. So coming and listening to these conversations really, I think, lights a little bit of fire, makes you more committed to the work when you go home and to bringing in other legislators.
And what are you aiming for politically? What level?
I'm very happy where I am. I think that that is the perfect level. I really have a lot of admiration for people who work in the municipal government, but I think state level is the sweet spot where you can influence policy, but you still have a very tangible connection to your constituents.
Representative Lindsay Sabadosa of Massachusetts. Official government representatives proved difficult to find and talk to, as so many of their sessions were not available to the public or even the press. But I did manage to speak with two members of their country's parliaments. Here is one of them. Bill Kidd is a member of Scottish Parliament, and he minced no words at the difficult situation his country is in regarding nuclear weapons and passing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
I'm Bill Kidd, member of the Scottish Parliament, and I'm here for the Parliamentarians Conference, which will be taking place here on Monday, which is today, obviously.
Has Scotland signed yet?
Scotland cannot sign at the moment because we are not as yet an independent country, but when we are, it's already been a commitment of the Scottish Government that we will be signatories, yeah.
What is it going to take to put the pressure on the UK to actually sign on this? Do you think that that's something that is feasible?
It won't be feasible unless the United States sign it, because the UK wouldn't take that on themselves. However, I think it's this constant pressure from nations across the world standing together in behalf of their peoples, which will eventually build to the kind of pressure on the nuclear weapon states that will force them to be much more reasonable.
It sounds like you hold out some hope.
Always hold out hope, because if you didn't, then there wouldn't be any point in being here. I believe, not just hopeful, but I believe that we will achieve this. I don't want it to take forever, so because we don't have that time, as has been said but many times already today. One accident could lead to who knows what, in which case it will be beyond beyond any of us. But that's why we have to stand together and work for it now.
Bill Kidd of Scottish Parliament. This is just a taste of what is to come, and I look forward to sharing this year's interviews at the third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Activists, shout out.
Here with a shout out to our shared nuclear past is another in our monthly series of stories from Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor newsletter.
The work of the Nuclear Resistor began back in 1980 when anti-nuclear power alliances and groups protesting the nuclear arms race were mushrooming up across the country. Friends had gone to jail for some of these protests, and we believed that more were headed there as these movements grew. History had taught us that in any significant movement for social change, many committed people are imprisoned, and that support for them is essential to the success of the movement. That awareness has been the foundation of our work for the past 45 years. When putting together the first issue of the small newsletter that would become the Nuclear Resistor, I read an article about the arrest of 8 people inside a General Electric factory outside Philadelphia. They were in jail and facing multiple charges for intentionally smashing 2 nuclear warhead nose cones and pouring blood on blueprints. It was serendipity that this daring act of direct disarmament became the only action, and these were the only jailed activists reported in that first issue. So who were these people? Later known as the Plowshares 8, they'd come together through the Atlantic Life Community, a network of faith-based communities and activists focused on the issue of nuclear proliferation with a specific commitment to resistance actions and civil disobedience. They were the brothers Daniel and Philip Berrigan, Catholic priests known for burning draft board records to protest the war in Vietnam, the Oblate missionary priest Carl Cabot, Anne Montgomery, an educator and Society of the Sacred Heart nun, Elmer Moss, a musician and scholar, Marine Corps veteran and attorney John Shushart, Yale Divinity School student Dean Hammer, and Molly Rush, a mother of 6. Early on the morning of September 9th, these 8 had joined hundreds of workers walking into the GE factory in a town named King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Entering the building where they believed parts for nuclear weapons were being assembled, they pushed their way past an unarmed security guard. Elmer Moss described what happened next. "We walked inside and opened up cases that would carry destructive power 30 times the power of the bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima, Japan in 1945. Standing in front of these nose cones that we pulled out of the cases, we held up our hammers and baby bottles filled with human blood, a symbol of the life that had been shed because of these weapons. And we destroyed those 2 nose cones. We hammered on them until they were incapable of being used by anybody to kill." When Molly Rush brought her hammer down on one of the nose cones, a piece of it chipped off and struck her chin. And the thought came to her, "They're not really invulnerable. They really are not. We're vulnerable, but so are they." And Molly realized, that means that human beings have made these, and human beings can unmake them. In their statement, they declared inspiration from the Old Testament prophets Isaiah and Micah, who called on God's faithful to beat their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. The Plowshares 8 had begun this fundamentally human task of nuclear disarmament. Their hammers sparked a movement, their sound echoing around the globe in more than 100 such Plowshares actions since, each a story to tell in itself. More than 200 people have taken part, some in more than one action, and served up to 18 years in prison. About 60 of these actions have taken place in the United States and more than 40 abroad, in Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Holland, Sweden, Italy, Scotland, and England. A full chronology can be found on the Kings Bay Plowshares 7 website. The dramatic trial of the Plowshares 8 was recreated by Emile D'Antonio for his 1982 arthouse film, In the King of Prussia. Starring Martin Sheen as the judge and the defendants as themselves, it was filmed on the eve of their sentencing, and you can watch it on YouTube. They were sentenced to prison terms of 5 to 10 years. After years of appeals, they were resentenced in 1990 to time served, from 5 days to almost 10 months. And their legacy lives on. This has been Jack Cohen-Japa for Nuclear Hot Seat, bringing you another story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
A great reminder of our past successes. If you are in New York next week on Tuesday, March 2nd, the Nuclear Free Future Awards are going to be awarded for 2025. This will take place in the Great Hall of Cooper Union in New York. And the awards this year will honor individuals from Brazil, India, Navajo Country, the United States, and Zimbabwe for their achievements in working for a nuclear-free world. The award laureates are chosen by an international jury of their peers and are offered in three categories: resistance, education, and solution. The event is free and begins at 6 p.m. on March 4th. Cooper Union's Great Hall is at 7 East 7th Street in New York. It is a joyous event. Our Academy Awards crossed with the prom. And all of you are invited to attend. And Setsko Thurlow has a moving op-ed that she addressed to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Dear Prime Minister, please address the nuclear threat to life on Earth, from a Hiroshima survivor. Setsko Thurlow has long been involved with the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons and jointly accepted the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of that group in 2017. As a Canadian citizen, her outreach to outgoing Prime Minister Trudeau is extremely powerful, and we will have a link to it up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 713. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way for you to make certain you don't miss a single episode. If you listen to a lot of podcasts, you can sign up on any of the podcast platforms, but there's an easier way. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, fill in the yellow opt-in box with your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, only one email from us, and it will contain a link to that week's episode and a short description of the show's content. It goes out as soon as the show gets posted, so that way you get it hot off the metaphoric press. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember always, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, especially for this trip, no amount too small, no amount too large, and we always appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use is allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as President John F. Kennedy said as a warning during the Cuban Missile Crisis, nuclear deterrence works brilliantly until it stops working. And then none of us will be alive to tell them, meaning the military leaders, that they were wrong. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.